As you know, in season 10, we're really working to look at the eight limbs of yoga as a regulatory framework for both the mind, and we talk a lot about Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, but also the nervous system as seen by modern science. We're trying to bring these things together. So our episode today is about conditioning the mind. And how does conditioning your mind affect your autonomic nervous system through the lens of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra? We've talked a little bit about how Patanjali's Yoga Sutra is a guidebook for daily living. It's, hey, you've showed up on the planet. You truly are a Purusha in this individual container called your body, mind, spirit vessel. And now you have to figure out how to live here. And all four chapters are showing us how to live in this human system, but also knowing that there is a part of us that is also divine. So in the beginning, as it starts out, right away, it says, now we begin yoga. And yoga begins with observation. Doesn't begin with action. It begins with, we're here now. Let us sit, let us feel, let us breathe, let us observe. We're going to observe our lived experience. That's what Sutra 1.1 says. Yoga Anushasanam is, this is a lived experience. This isn't science. This isn't something out of a textbook. This isn't theory. This is, how does it feel to be in your body right here, right now? And in order to hopefully have less suffering, or at the very least accept our suffering, we have to study the mind, which then has an impact on the nervous system, as we know. So there's a really big word that I love. It's called the phenomenological approach. And it basically means the approach of having a lived experience, that we don't need anyone else to validate for us what our lived experience is. And that this phenomenological approach has been happening for several thousand years in the study of yoga. That many, many sages and yogis have come before us, and they've had this first-hand experience of being human, and they wrote down, hey, here's the things we learned about how we can suffer less. So what that means is we can go back to the texts like Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, which is, you know, a Raja Yoga. A Raja Yoga means yoga of the mind. And we can study how it is that the mind works. And then, of course, how do the fluctuations of the mind impact your nervous system? Welcome to the Yoga Therapy Hour. My name is Amy Wheeler, and I am your host. Today, we're going to do a solo episode with me, and we're still going deeply into the eight limbs of yoga this year. So let's go ahead and get started. So let's start at the beginning. We have patterns in our mind. We have patterns or fluctuations. Yoga Sutra chapter 1 verse 2 says, yoga chitta vritti nirodaha. Yoga is the regulation, the refinement, and maybe, just maybe, the stilling of the fluctuations of the mind field. So we have to start here, and we have to realize that what goes through our minds, and I don't just mean our brains, but I mean our mind, body, spirit container, it's not random. It is patterned. Your entire personality is just patterns that you picked up from the womb all the way till now. That's all your personality is. I'm so sorry to tell you that. And that these repeated patterns become grooves. They become deep grooves much of the time, and deep tendencies where you think you have free will or free choice. Maybe, but maybe it's just the way you've always done things and the way you're mind body tells you to do things. And then over time, these deep, deep grooves that become our tendencies eventually solidify like cement into our identity. Now, remember, that all started with thought patterns, thought feeling patterns, let's say, that this process went from grooves to tendencies to cement-like identity. And what are we trying to do? We're trying to reverse that. We're trying to break up the cement, get you a little less connected to your identity, because it's just patterns, it's just habits. Get you a little less dependent on your tendencies and help you start to see the grooves of your mind and your body and your physiology so that you can figure out, oh, how could I suffer less? And really, that's what Patanjali is talking about. Now, in yogic terms, we call those grooves samskaras, habitual patterns, and they kind of accumulate. They're unconscious to us many times. And then over time, when these samskaras accumulate and start driving our perception of how we view the world, other people, they start driving how we process information. What do we see, hear, think, feel? And then how do we feel about that? And then how does that cascade into our physiology? Which, of course, we start believing, we start thinking, oh, I'm an anxious person or I'm a depressed person. And then we identify, I'm an unwell person or I'm never going to be able to do X, Y, Z. So these samskaras, they begin to accumulate. And this is not to say that every samskara can be erased, right? There's a lot of things that come through genetically that are very, very hard to overcome. And I don't want to discount any of that. And there's many things in society structurally and systemically that are making it very, very challenging or difficult or maybe even impossible to restructure how we view the world and our responses to it. And all of that is true, yes, and what we're doing in yoga is saying, well, what do we have control over? If we know all that to be true, is there anything I can do to suffer less or maybe even to help other people suffer less? So we have to look at the samskara as, okay, there are some things out there, but what can I do? Now, one more thing I want to put in here. When we accumulate these samskaras over time and they become part of our identity, and we can no longer separate out our identity from the fact that we are a divine being of Purusha, when they get really, really deep, they actually lay the foundation for your next perception, your next inclination, your next tendency, your next identity. And we call that a vasana, V-A-S-A-N-A, a vasana. And that fertile ground sends you into more samskaras. So we have this kind of loop that happens, and somehow, some way, through our yogic practices, specifically through meditation and Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, we can start to figure out how to interrupt that cycle, how to stop living from those automatic habitual patterns, which our nervous system, our physiology begins to mirror. And of course, it feels very real. How could it feel anything other than that? Because this is our experience of being human. So let's begin by talking about samskara and the autonomic nervous system. When we have these pattern thoughts that repeat and repeat and repeat, the body follows, the physiology follows. When you have emotions that become habitual, your physiology will follow. So it's happening in the mind at a more subtle level, but eventually neurons that fire together wire together, it becomes part of your body's response to that thought. And now there's no separation. What's really interesting is that neuroscience says once we start to feel these things physiologically, even if we didn't have that thought, but that same feeling or sensation comes into our body, we will then, in real time, find a story about why we are sensing that thing in our body. And the story that we find to tell ourselves why my stomach hurts, or why am I sweating, or why is my face all red, or why is my heart pounding, is often incorrect. It's just like, oh, close enough story. Let's take that one. So one of the first things we have to learn to do is kind of break apart this chain of here's what I'm thinking, here's what my emotions are, here's what I'm feeling physiologically. Start to break apart those chains so that we don't believe everything that we think, every emotion we have, and every physiological response that we have. I'll give you a great example. Oftentimes, if I drink coffee in the morning and I've got the morning cortisol rush, which isn't unusual, those two things could get very linked together. But what I've started doing is saying, number one, I'm going to take the coffee out of the equation. I probably don't need it first thing in the morning for my physiology. But number two, if I do happen to have it, I tell myself, oh, Amy, that sensation of anxiety that you're having in your body is actually the coffee. You're not anxious, Amy. Don't sit here and try to figure out why you're so anxious. It's just the coffee. So basically, I'm kind of pulling apart the physiological feelings from the story that I'm telling. And you could do it the other way too. You could pair it together and say, oh, this is why this is happening. But really what I want us to get across is that we don't have to believe every single thing our mind thinks, which is really hard. The reason that's hard is because we want to learn to trust ourselves. And so if we start telling ourselves, hey, don't believe that sensation, don't believe that thought, it's just a pattern. Some would say, well, how can I trust myself? I think over time, when we start breaking these things apart, with what is left over, we basically get to know ourselves again, which is super, super cool to get to know yourself outside as the observer of these patterns and thoughts. So if we're to put a yogic lens on this, we could say these habitual patterns in our mind, in our emotions, in our personality, in our nervous system, they're just the gunas, the rajas, the tamas, the sattva, expressing themselves through the mind and body. And we could just say, hey, I've got rajas today. That feels like sympathetic activation. Or, oh, I'm feeling so tamasic today. That could be the withdrawal or the exhaustion or the depletion. Or, wow, I'm feeling very sattvic today. And I feel very clear and steady. So just to know that the fluctuations of the gunas will happen because we're in this human body. It's not separate from the mind. It's almost like an embodied mind. Whereas in Western science, we've kind of separated the body from the mind. With the gunas, the body and the mind are one. It's all happening together. So we're not really denying the body or mind. We're just watching and observing the patterns of the gunas. We're watching them be flexible. We're watching our response to how does it feel to be exhausted, depleted, or collapsed? How does it feel to be really activated or anxious or agitated? How does it feel to be calm and centered and grounded? You are the observer of your own gunas. And we're not even trying to get into sattva all the time, right? We're just trying to watch which habitual patterns are pleasant, which ones are unpleasant. And in step one, we're just observing it and trying to figure out how to suffer a little bit less. I would say down the road, we're trying to have fewer preferences. But that's step two for most of us. Right now, just watching with awareness what's happening inside of us and what is activating us or collapsing us would be a great first step. So we've talked about the thoughts of the mind, the emotions of the heart, the physiology. Let's talk about our emotional habits, as well as the kleshas. The five kleshas are the causes of suffering. And how is it that we start repeating the same emotional states? And why does the body want to recreate these familiar sensations inside? Maybe let's just take the example of someone who is an over-exerciser, and they're putting themselves into a very, very high sympathetic state of arousal or activation every single day for 90 minutes. And they love that feeling of rajas. Right. Well, that bleeds into how they communicate with their colleagues or their family. Could be very short, very direct, very hurtful at times because there's so much pitta and so much rajas. And so, on one hand, we're repeating this feeling of high sympathetic activation, and it's working for us in the gym. But we take that into our lives and it's no longer working for us. So that might be something we could examine. Another example might be someone who loves to dive deeply into their work. Maybe some people call them a workaholic, but to them, it's like a deep dive into this thing that they're so interested in. And all that exists is you and your ideas and getting these amazing thoughts out there to the world, and it feels really, really good. But it could be other people in your life feel like you're ignoring them, you're not paying attention, you're not present, you're not spending time. So, first, I just want to say that our habitual habits of our emotions and our kleshas, they serve good things and bad things. They're not all one. It's always a mix. It's the yin and the yang together. If you want to go to Chinese medicine, we would say it's the rajas and the tamas together. Like that's what it means to be human. So Patanjali gives these kind of habitual emotional patterns names. Avidya means misperception. You're not perceiving clearly because you have too much rajas or too much tamas. If you were in sattva, you would perceive more clearly. Asmita, overly identifying with something, thinking that you are this, you are that, you are the professor, you are the mother, you are the daughter, you are the husband or wife, you are the fisherman, you are the top triathlete in your town, you are the musician of the family, right? That identifying with these characteristics that you bring to the table. You could even identify with unhelpful things like I'm the one who went to prison, or I'm the one who cheated on my partner, or I'm the one who is a bad mom or dad, right? This identification of I am that and forgetting who you really are, that there is a place inside you that is untouched by suffering, that is flawless, that is all-knowing, that is eternal, that is not touched by your current suffering. So when we talk about asmita, we're just saying you're identifying with something and thinking, I am this thing, when really you're so much more than that. That is a tiny slice of who you really are. The next klesha, or if you want to call it emotional habit, is raga. This clinging, I must have, I must be, I must do. I can't be happy without. I really like, I prefer, I want it my way. Do it my way because I'm smart and I can tell you how to do it. I must control you. I must be in charge, right? This is raga, very, very connected to rajas. Dvesha. Ugh, I don't like it. Bad juju, bad energy, don't like this task, don't want to do it, get it away from me. I no longer want to communicate. You know, that person is a narcissist. Like all of this push, push, push away, not realizing that everything that we push away actually comes back around instead of if we could just sitting with the clinging or the aversion and exploring that. And saying, wow, what does that mean to me? What physiological sensations am I having inside? Oh gosh, that's uncomfortable. What color is that? What texture is that? Where do I feel that in my body? Is it dissipating? Is it building? Or wow, there's a lot of thoughts and stories that come up when I ponder this clinging or this aversion. What would it be like to settle down my mind and not go right to the story and just stay with the sensations? Most of us can't sit with it because we are too activated. It's very, very hard to sit with something when you've got a lot of activation happening. So it's kind of like what came first, the chicken or the egg. Here we're asking ourselves to observe, but we're too activated to sit quietly and observe. Let's take just a moment away from the episode to talk about a brand new program that we have coming at Notre Dame of Maryland School of Integrative Health. In addition to our Masters of Science in Yoga Therapy, we've developed a new certificate program. This certificate program is specifically designed for people who have licensed healthcare practitioner status or have a master's degree in some other field, but you'd love to get a certificate in therapeutic yoga to be able to help your clients in clinical settings, educational settings, and community health and wellness. This program for people who already have LHCP or have a master's degree is a 15-month program. It's one class per semester, and it's a really fantastic, groundbreaking program, unlike any other program I've seen in the nation. I'd love for you to come and check out our LHCP therapeutic yoga program at Notre Dame of Maryland. We have open houses every month, and we can tell you all about it, or you can email me to get more information. Thanks so much for listening, and back to the episode. The last emotional habit that we're going to name is abhinivesha, the fear-based holding. I will lose this. I can't have that. I don't know what I'll do without that. I don't like change. I can't stand the thought of not being with this person, this job, this location. I want to avoid anything that might hurt me, and I'm having a lot of fear about it, right? Things in the future that I imagine might hurt me that I'm scared of, things from the past that I'm imagining might come back and hurt me again. So these are the kleshas, but what we're doing with our yoga practice, we hope, is identifying the patterns. Which ones tend to come up often? How do they show up? What situations do they likely show up? What patterns do I see in my life, within myself, but also interpersonally? How am I reinforcing these? How do I keep stepping into the same hole over and over and over? What do I need to watch out for so that I don't keep suffering? So there's observing that. But there's also knowing that your body, your emotional chemistry, your physiology begins to expect a certain pattern daily. It expects the coffee in the morning. It expects the wine in the evening. It expects the high after the workout. It expects the feeling, sensing, activation that you have when you talk to your boss. So the body begins to accept. The body begins to know what the chemistry is going to be, what's happening, and it consciously or unconsciously tries to go for that which is familiar. So what we have to learn to do, I heard someone say this so recently, it was so beautiful, we don't want to suppress these emotions and these feelings and then sensations. We have to look at the wholeness of them. So when we're feeling happy, we have to also allow ourselves to imagine what it's going to be like when we're not so happy. So I get a raise. I'm so happy, but I'm probably going to be asked to do a few more things at work, which is going to compress my time and energy with my family. Not so happy, right? That we can hold both of those at the same time. It could be the other way. Could be that we have some really, really sad feelings of loss or grief. And at those times, it's hard to remember back to all the good times that happened as part of that relationship that you've now lost. But we would ask you to look at the wholeness of it so you can hold all of it together and that your mind, your body, your physiology, your nervous system doesn't become accustomed to a very, very narrow window of tolerance. We actually want you to be able to feel multiple complex emotions, thoughts, feelings, sensations over time. I mean, some people would say that's what it means to be enlightened, that you can tolerate this without suppressing. You can be present to it and be with it, be in the flow with it. That's so interesting to me. So the whole first part of chapter one in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra is looking at this idea of your patterns, where your mind tends to go, the different states of mind, and really kind of getting a handle on observing that. And then by the time we get to Yoga Sutra 112, which talks about abhyasa and vairagyam, now we're talking about how are we going to repattern the system, the mind, the body, the breath, the nervous system, the reactions, the communication style, even the perception. How are we going to reprogram that for less suffering, or at the very least, accepting what is while we are suffering? So in Yoga Sutra 112, Abhyasa Vairagyam Tan Nirodha, basically it's saying through steady practice of regulation and non-attachment, we can reprogram the mind, the body, the nervous system. So abhyasa means continuing to repeat, a return to self, a return to the observer, a commitment to understanding your own patterns of destabilization, your own patterns of dysregulation, and being with them, being with the good and the bad of that, and working back towards more stabilization, towards more clarity. And it doesn't mean that we're trying to get you to be sattvic all the time. It's more like, oh, here comes a wave. I'm getting activated. I'm really, really activated. Now is not the time to send the email. Let's sit with the activation. Let's feel it. And then a day or two later, it may come down. And then we watch that come down. Okay, this is how I'm feeling now. Is this a good time to send that email, right? So it's that ability to watch ourselves go up or watch ourselves go down. It could be that you had too much to drink one evening and you feel really depressed for the upcoming 48 hours because alcohol is a depressant. And you're like, wow, I'm really watching how depressed I feel. I'm not getting attached to stories. I'm not telling myself I'm a depressed person. I just think I drank too much wine and my entire system is depressed physiologically. No story, right? So that ability, that commitment, abhyasa, to watch the fluctuations of the mind, the body, the nervous system, knowing how to get back to a state of sattva and clarity, but also knowing that, hey, we're not going to stay there in that sattvic state all the time. And then the vairagyam part of this is how do we stop reinforcing the old identity, the one that's not working for us, the one that is causing us suffering? We oftentimes say we hold on to something very dysfunctional because it's familiar until it causes so much pain that we can't hold on to it anymore. And what Patanjali is saying is, do you have to wait till you hit your rock bottom? At any time, you can decide, I am not this identity. I am not clinging to this version of myself. And you can allow the emotional states to soften. You can allow your physiology to soften. And you can allow your patterns to soften. It's a process of giving yourself the time and space to soften so that you can then come back and determine, do I want to cling to this old identity or do I want to create something new? Because in yogic language, when we are creating the new patterns that cause us less suffering, we might have one name for that, but really what that is neuroplasticity. We're wiring and firing new patterns together. So we're not really constructing a new ego. That's not the goal. We're loosening our identifications. We're loosening our conditioning. And we're allowing something much deeper to emerge in its place. Something unknown, something gray, the gray area, the area we don't have control over. I just kind of imagine it like you're in a canoe going down a river and you kind of let the current take you. Right? So that's a new way of being for most of us. that we have a certain amount of vairagya, more detachment. We allow the water to do some of the work. It's not just us rowing. Us rowing would be the ego identification versus I'm going to let the water take me and I'm going to, you know, stick my little row in the water once in a while and push off a rock or maybe head over to one side of the river. It looks a little less rough over here. So that's really, you know, this idea of flowing down the river and letting the universe take you is kind of where we're going, that amount of detachment. So how does this affect our meditation practice if we've decided to have a meditation practice? Because ultimately, that's what Patanjali is suggesting would help us. The meditation of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra that allows for a restructuring of the mind, the physiology, and the nervous system is not Zen meditation. It's not Vipassana meditation. It's not TM, transcendental meditation. It's its very own yogic meditation as explained by Patanjali. And so I kind of like to call it a reflective meditation at first, where we begin to notice the fluctuations of our mind instead of kind of being unconsciously driven by them. And then over time, as we start to watch our own mind and our own physiology, it could be really uncomfortable to watch that and to watch the stories that come up. But eventually, we hope that the rajas and the tamas will begin to settle and sattva will increase. And then, of course, physiologically, the breath steadies, the heart rate variability improves, the interoceptive awareness is improved, the nervous system becomes more flexible. So the goal is not totally calm state of mind. It's this ability to engage with life in real time and not get thrown off so easily, and being able to come back to a place of psychological and nervous system flexibility. That's really what we mean by resilience. That, you know, we could even call it your adaptability, your willingness and ability to not have so much control in life and to be able to drive your canoe with the current. Now, when I say that yogic meditation has kind of a different way of doing this than some of the others that I mentioned, again, they're all great ways of meditation. They're just not the way that Patanjali lays out. Patanjali says we will find an object of meditation. We will begin to concentrate on that object of meditation. We call that dharana, which is limb number 6 out of 8. And we will try to focus our attention on that object of meditation. The next step, dhyanam, which is the 7th out of 8 steps, is where we kind of begin to be imbued and absorbed with our object of meditation. And our focus is so strong that we begin to take on some of those qualities of our object of meditation. The last step, samadhi, is where we are so absorbed that we become that object of meditation. We lose the sense of I-ness and we gain the sense of oneness. And that's the 8th limb out of 8 limbs of yoga. Now, these three together, the concentration, now I'm imbued with this object of meditation and its qualities, and now I've lost my sense of I-ness. That is what we call samyama. That's the word that kind of encompasses all three of those. So let's just give an example of what this might look like. Maybe you decide that your object of meditation is metta, M-E-T-T-A, metta meditation. I'm going to be friendly and kind and appreciative and considerate. And I'm going to be a very pleasant person in the world. So I'm doing metta meditation. In the 6th step, you're just trying to sit down and do some metta meditation, right? In the 7th limb, you're getting into it. You're feeling it. You oftentimes leave your meditation like, oh, that was just such a nice metta meditation today. I'm going to take these qualities all throughout my day. And then in the 8th limb, the samadhi, you become metta. You are metta. You just are. That's who you are. You could say the same for Tonglen meditation, right? Tonglen meditation is where I take in the suffering of others and I give out peace and love and joy to them. You could go through those three phases. You really have to focus on trying to do it. Then it starts to work and you become the person who can take on the suffering of others and give out peace. And then you are that. We could go through so many different objects of meditation. Lakshmi with abundance. We could go through Kuan Yin with compassion. It's always the same three steps, dharana, dhyana, samadhi, the last three limbs of yoga. So it's interesting when we start to think about stabilizing our mind, our body, our physiology, our nervous system through this form of meditation. It basically means different people need different objects of meditation to stabilize them. What I need to bring myself from rajas to sattva is different than what somebody else needs to bring themselves from tamas to sattva. And this is why we have a yoga therapist, a yoga teacher, a wise guide, someone who can help us choose the object of meditation that's going to bring our system into, let's call it sattva stabilization more often, and also the ability to flex with what life brings to us. So when I look at yoga therapy, I'm wondering how many schools out there are actually teaching actual Patanjali yogic meditation. Or are we doing some postures, doing some breath work, and then borrowing Vipassana, or borrowing the Zen meditation, or borrowing? Why would we do that? We have this beautiful system. And chapter three of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra just completely lays it out. Here's how you do yogic meditation. And then chapter four, here are the results if you choose to do yogic meditation. So I guess one of my calls in this whole series that we're going to be doing this year is to help us start thinking and claiming yogic meditation, figuring out the objects of meditation that are going to work to help people transform from the inside out, right? Now, let's get back to the beginning. We talked about you and I are made up of these samskaras, these habitual patterns that turn into a deep cement-like identity, and that the ultimate goal is to start to break some of that down, to soften some of it. And then I would say at the end of our journey, we want to transcend that identity. We want to move past it. We want to understand, I am Purusha. I am the light. There is something very sacred and precious in me that is eternal and all-knowing, that is free of fear and free of attachments and aversions and misperception, and that I can begin to identify with that pattern or what is beyond my personality, my thoughts, my judgments, my biases, my strong opinions, my thoughts, and even my physiology. Can we remember, as we're sorting through all of this without a spiritual bypass, can we remember who we are beyond the patterns? And that's what Yoga Sutra 1.3 is saying. Tada drashtuhu svarupa avasthanam. The observer, you, are able to rest in your own true nature beyond the patterns, beyond the personality, beyond your physiology, beyond your sensations, beyond the stories that you tell yourself. There's something much deeper than that inside of you, and that's what your true nature is. So always remembering, you're not the pattern. You're not the conditioned nervous system. You're not the conditioned thoughts that you're having. You're not the conditioned emotions that you're having. And you're not even the movement or fluctuation of the gunas. All of these patterns move, they change, they shift, but there's one thing that stays steady. That's the observer. Some people call it the witness. So we're doing the work in the human form to unpack all of this and remembering who we really are. Now, I do not love the idea of just forgetting the human body, forgetting the physiology, forgetting all the patterns and habits and kleshas, and just going up to I am a form of the divine. We have a lot more work to do than that. We really do need to look at ourselves in this human body, in this human experience, at the same time that we remember who we really are. And why? Because we cause ourselves suffering, but we also cause a lot of other people suffering too. So it is our responsibility to do our best to suffer less and to hurt other people less. So this journey that we are on is that we are working to observe ourselves and hopefully let go and soften, to watch the patterns, to reduce identification, to find clarity, to come into balance, but also to be able to ride the waves of, I'm very activated, I'm not going to do anything right now, I'm not going to have a hard conversation, I'm not going to send the email, or, oh my God, I'm just so lethargic and depleted. This is also not a good time for me to talk or act or be with others. So like watching those extremes and knowing when is the right time to act with right action. And if we do this over time, the autonomic nervous system will reorganize itself and the mind will also reorganize itself. And the neurons that fire together and wire together will be new again. Your nervous system and your mind will start to have new conditioned patterns, hopefully a little closer to sattvic and a little bit less suffering. Now, I'm just going to throw one more thing in here because it's so interesting to me. This ability to reorganize, the reorganization happens most easily when you're in deep states of meditation. But most of us cannot get into deep states of meditation because we are having the fluctuations of the gunas so intensely. So what we really need to do is reorganize our lifestyle so that our gunas can be a little bit more in balance. We need to eventually start taking out the things that are really causing us a lot of suffering, if we can, so that the chances of us getting into deep states of meditation are more possible. I think sometimes when people do psychedelics, drugs, this is what's happening. They're getting into the deeper state of mind and it feels like, oh my gosh, I can create something new from here, which is fine. In the fourth chapter of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, the very first sutra says, Oshadhi, drugs can help you. The thing that Patanjali says about that is it won't be permanent. It will be a glimpse, which is, you know, for some people, if they want a glimpse of what it could be like to get into very deep states of meditation, sometimes that can be helpful. But if we're really talking about a more permanent reorganization of your mind and your nervous system, it's the daily sadhana, the daily practice that's going to balance the gunas and bring more awareness and start to have you shifting your physiology, shifting your habitual emotional patterns, shifting your thoughts, unpacking, softening. I think a nice intermediate way for many of us to do this work that isn't deep, deep samadhi, but it's kind of like something we could do is yoga nidra. For a lot of people, depending on the yoga nidra that they're doing, it can be a little jumpstart. It can be a way to soften and unpack and get in touch with something larger than yourself. And then you can bring those feelings, thoughts, and sensations from the experience of the yoga nidra into your daily life and maybe find a new way of living, a new way of perceiving, a new way of relating, a new way of responding. So I really am a believer in the power of yoga nidra. Because I think if we do it within this context of the eight limbs of yoga, where we find an object of meditation, we become imbued with those qualities during the yoga nidra, and maybe have a glimpse of samadhi in the yoga nidra, we can take that experience into our humanness. And that might be until we get a lifestyle where we can really go into deep states of meditation on a regular basis. Maybe yoga nidra is the thing that can start to get us there. I do want to say, and I hope I don't upset anybody saying this, but I just want to say that yoga nidras that have a lot of external distraction. Look at the boat, look at the flower, look at the horse. Da, da. What we're talking about is an internal experience. You shaping you. You finding your body, finding your breath, finding your mental habits, finding your emotions, finding your physiology. Turn inward and go deeply with your meditation and your yoga nidra instead of something out there. Not sure what that looks like, but I do have a lot of yoga nidra tapes on the Optimal State mobile app. If you'd like to experience what that might be like, maybe that would be a good place to start. And then, of course, if you need a teacher that you would want a personalized yoga nidra meditation that's based on these teachings that could be just for you, of course, I could make a recommendation. You could go to www.theoptimalstate.com and I could definitely set you up with a teacher that could help you have a personalized experience of this, which is, of course, the most powerful, to have it made for you, by you, with you. All right, so let's just have a few closing reflections as we go off into the world this week. Start to notice your recurring emotional patterns, both in meditation but also in life. Start to notice and track your habitual physiological states and what might be causing those physiological states. Noticing when you're feeling very sympathetically activated and when you're feeling very lethargic and maybe collapsing or withdrawing, and then noticing those times you actually feel good and have this sense of well-being. Then just remember that yoga isn't asking you to be somebody else. It's asking you to strip your identity of who you think you are and see what's left over. There's something inside you that's already there. It's just got a lot of covering. So what we're asking and inviting you to do is remember what inside of you is steady beneath the conditioning of your life. And then as you tune into that steadiness, your mind becomes more clear, your nervous system starts to settle, and we hope that gradually your suffering decreases. All right, everyone, it's been very lovely to be with you today. I hope you've enjoyed our time together, and we'll see you next week. Have a great one.
A way that you can help support the Yoga Therapy Hour. Our Optimal State mobile app is available for both Android and iPhone. We've really simplified the check-in process, and it's a way to track your nervous system regulation, as well as your physical health and mental health. It can be part of your personal or professional practice. And by that, what we mean is that you might like to track your own nervous system, mental and physical health, and see the data for yourself, as well as receive interventions, do yoga nidras, breath work, meditation. All of it is on the app, and new content is being added all the time. But a second way you might like to use it is to recommend that your clients, your students, also use the app so that they can show you the data about their nervous system, about their mental and physical health. You can see where they've been in the weeks or months between the times that you meet with them as a practitioner. The app offers structured practices, self-assessment tools, and it's guided and rooted in yoga therapy and nervous system science. It's designed to help you track your state and begin to understand what shifts you and how to choose practices that will bring you back into balance. Whether you're using it for your own well-being or integrating it into the care for others that you offer, we'd love for you to come check it out and do the 3-week free trial. After that, it's about $5 a month. It's a tool that can support you and also the Yoga Therapy Hour podcast. Thanks for listening to this small way that you can support the Yoga Therapy Hour.
We wish you a wonderful week. We hope that somehow, in a small way, we've contributed to your well-being so that you can go out and share that well-being with others. That's what life is all about, bringing in the goodness through you and then shining it out to the world. We need you more than ever.
So let's all get out there, do good, be good, and have a great week.